Ruby did not exist before this episode. What they are about to describe is happening across Northwest as you listen. This is their story. In Ribble Valley, nursing training places sit empty while wards struggle with staff shortages. Not because people don't want to train as nurses, but because Treasury spending limits have severed the link between healthcare needs and the education that could meet them. Ruby's voice carries the frustration of someone who discovered that the barrier was never about ability or demand, but about a political choice dressed as financial necessity.
I grew up watching my grandmother wait 3 weeks to see a GP about chest pains that turned out to be her heart. She died 6 months later, and I still wonder if earlier care might have made a difference. My mum was a teaching assistant, my dad fixed cars, and neither of them knew how to push back when the surgery said, "That's the earliest appointment we have." I decided I'd become a nurse, so no family in Ribble Valley would have to watch someone they love suffer from lack of care. I finished my A-levels at Ribblesdale High in 2018 and applied to study nursing at the University of Central Lancashire. They accepted me straight away. I had the grades, the personal statement that made the admissions tutor cry, and references that called me exactly what the HS needs. 3 weeks later, Health Education England sent a letter. Due to Treasury spending constraints on healthcare education budgets, your funded training place has been withdrawn. Just like that. No explanation of what these constraints were or who had decided them. I took a job as a healthcare assistant at Royal Blackburn Hospital and reapplied the following year. Same acceptance, same enthusiasm from the university, then the same rejection. We simply don't have the funding allocation from HM Treasury to support more nursing students. The woman on the phone sounded genuinely sorry. She said they'd had to turn away 60 qualified applicants that year alone. I asked what Treasury spending constraints meant, and she said they were told to treat each training place as a cost that had to be justified against competing priorities. In 2020, I tried a third time. By now, I'd been working on the wards for 2 years, seeing the staff shortages firsthand. Nurses doing double shifts, agency staff covering basic care, patients waiting hours for medication because there weren't enough hands. The local MP had been in the papers saying recruitment was a priority. When Health Education England rejected me, again with the exact same language about funding allocations, something snapped. I walked past the university nursing building that afternoon, furious and tired. The sign outside said, "Nursing Training Facility," preparing tomorrow's healthcare heroes. Through the windows, I could see lecture halls sitting empty, rows and rows of seats with nobody in them. Computer labs with dust on the keyboards. I walked inside and found a lecturer packing up from what looked like a half-empty seminar. "Are you short of students?" I asked. She laughed, but not in a funny way. "We've got capacity for twice as many nursing students as we're allowed to take. The facilities are here, the staff are here, and we get hundreds more applications than we can accept. But Health Education England caps our numbers based on what HM Treasury says they can afford to spend on training." I told her about my rejections, about the other people I'd met who wanted to train. She nodded like she'd heard it all before. "The constraint isn't real resources," she said. "We could train them all if the funding formula wasn't designed around household budget thinking. The government that issues the pound tells us it can't find enough pounds to train the nurses the NHS is desperately short of." That conversation changed everything. I'd spent 3 years accepting that "there is no funding" was just how things worked. It sounded reasonable. Everyone said the same thing. The university administrators, the Health Education England officials, even the nursing staff I worked alongside. We all nodded when someone said the government couldn't afford more training places, but I could see the contradiction with my own eyes. The lecture halls were empty. The simulation labs sat unused. The lecturers wanted to teach. The students wanted to learn. The hospitals needed the staff. What exactly was it that there was no money for? The pounds don't grow in the ground. The government that prints them had chosen not to spend them into the training places that would connect willing people to essential work. I started to understand that this was never an accounting problem. It was a political decision wrapped in the language of financial impossibility. The same government that found hundreds of billions for bank bailouts and business support during COVID had told Health Education England it couldn't afford to train more nurses. Not because the training was impossible, not because the people didn't exist, but because Treasury orthodoxy treats public spending like a household managing its weekly budget. I'm still a healthcare assistant, I'm still reapplying each year, but I hear the excuses differently now. When someone says, we can't afford more nurse training, I remember those empty lecture halls. When politicians talk about difficult choices and limited resources, I think about the willing students and desperate wards existing side by side while Treasury spending limits keep them apart. I used to accept the excuse that there was no money. I hear it differently now. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins told me it could not find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there, ready to work. The real question was never about money, it was about whether the people existed, whether the skills could be taught, whether the facilities were available. They were. All of them. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice wrapped in the language of impossibility. It is the same logic as a household that says, we cannot afford it, except a household does not issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. What happened to me is happening in every constituency where health needs and willing healthcare workers exist, side by side, while someone in Westminster says the NHS training budget must be rationed like pocket money. The resources are there. The choice not to use them is political.
What Ruby experienced has a name: fake experts. This technique relies on citing authorities who present political choices as economic facts, treating their opinions as settled science. Think of tobacco companies in the 1960s funding scientists who claimed cigarettes were harmless, then pointing to these experts as proof. The technique works because people trust expertise, even when that expertise serves a particular agenda. In Ruby's story, unnamed economists were cited to justify spending limits on nurse training, as though the question of whether to train more nurses had a single scientific answer. Economists say we cannot spend more on health without causing inflation, Ruby was told. But which economists? The profession is deeply divided on government spending. Many macroeconomists argue that the binding constraint on spending is real capacity. People, skills, materials, not the currency itself. Economists say, without naming them, is an appeal to unnamed authority. The fake experts technique works by treating household budget thinking as economic law rather than political ideology. These authorities speak as though the UK government faces the same constraints as a family managing their weekly shopping, despite the obvious difference. Families don't issue their own currency. They present spending caps as technical necessities rather than political choices about priorities. The UK government issues its own currency. It does not need to find pounds before it spends them. The real constraint is resources. People, skills, materials, time. And in Ruby's constituency, those resources were sitting idle. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Ribble Valley ranks 477 out of 543 English constituencies in the English Indices of Deprivation 2025, published by MHCLG. The constituency has 3,181 registered charities according to the Charity Commission Register for England and Wales. Total grants received amount to £200.4 million, according to 360 Giving Grant Navy. All sources are published at blockedbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics. Produced by Blocked Britain.